Welcome to the Exchange Podcast with All Seated's Director of Marketing Growth, Nick Borelli. Nick chats with change agents, discussing their insights on what's next. This season, Exchange focuses on the metaverse and what it means for business. Subscribe now.
Welcome to Exchange, where we discuss what's next for intentional experience design with expert change agents. I'm your host, Nick Borelli, All Seated's Director of Marketing Growth. And this season of interviews is dedicated to demystifying the metaverse and explaining how the foundations of this emerging reality will change how we come together. Let's meet today's guest.
Hi, I'm Leslie Shannon. I am Nokia's Head of Innovation and Trend Scouting, which means that I spend all my time looking at the new technologies that are coming up that are going to change our lives, and the metaverse is right there at the top of my list.
Yeah, I bet that comes up in conversation quite often. It could be a drinking game, but then it would be dangerous, I assume.
Exactly. Yeah. Metaverse bingo. Oh, bingo.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. NFTs. Oh, bing, I got an L. That's funny. Yeah. Well, I mean, this season is all dedicated to the idea of the emerging metaverse, you know, like where we're at right now and kind of like making it so there's some clarity in what it is, what it means to people, and what to expect. So I'm going to kick off this conversation with a single question that actually usually branches off in a bunch of different directions. So are you ready for it?
I am.
Great. Okay. So do you agree with this statement? The metaverse doesn't exist yet.
Oh, I disagree. Oh, wow.
Excellent.
Oh. Oh,
I love it.
No, heck.
That's great. I've had people do a lot of yes ands or yes buts or no ands and no buts. And it ends up being like this conversation of now, here's how it's been split so far. Lowercase m, a capital M or a versus the in the modification of metaverse. And like there's all this like, well, yes, but, you know, the capital M or the metaverse, you know, is or isn't. I find that fun territory to, you know, kind of break into. Anywhere there's a split, I'm like, oh, good, there's a story
exactly.
There.
Let's
so what's
it.
Your take on all that stuff?
Well, okay, I see that where we are with the metaverse right now is kind of where we were with the internet in about 1993. You know, it exists. It is certainly not anything like its future format. In 1993, we didn't even really have a good search engine for the internet. It was just a bunch of really unconnected web pages and email. And so that's kind of where we are on the internet. There's no connective tissue yet. But the individual areas that will one day be connected up and form this grander fusion of the physical and the digital, which is really where all this is going, there's plenty of those elements. I mean, just this week, I was in a meeting in Spatial, I was in a meeting in Verbella, I was in a meeting in Raum, which is a German enterprise teams VR thing. I love Round, but mwah, love you guys. My kids spend all of their time playing Fortnite. I have two teenage boys. And for me, that's a metaverse as well. They're talking with their friends on Discord. They are physically in their rooms, but mentally where they are is in a fully digitized world where they are interacting with their friends and enemies and creating and, you know, doing things that have significance to them. And all of that to me spells metaverse.
That's great. Yeah. So, I mean, I got onto the internet around that same time, text only browsing, lots of Usenets and BBSs. For me, it was just a way to find community that I couldn't find in my school of Star Trek The Next Generation fans.
You know, exactly.
there was more 50-year-olds online that were doing it than teenagers. So I went from that, and I started building websites in the early 90s for a marketing firm as a one-man operation, as a novelty. And the what would become black hat techniques that I used because there wasn't any search engines were definitely dirty pool that sort of worked until it couldn't.
Exactly. I mean, we take for granted.
Unsophisticated.
Right, we take for granted all of the things that the internet has right now. But if you look at the really truly disruptive industries that have come out of the internet, and kind of Uber and Airbnb are kind of, you know, the poster children for that. The internet enabled them, but what they couldn't work without the mobile internet, without location technology, and without payment technology. And all of those elements do not yet exist in the metaverse. And so that's what I mean by connective tissue and kind of the common toolkit. It's that will be developed. And in fact, if you're listening to this and you're thinking about what would be a good business idea in the metaverse? Well, yeah, building those kind of connective tissue kinds of things. Yeah. There's going to be reputations and fortunes made in those kinds of tools. And so, you know, just throwing that out there.
Yeah, each generation. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well,
I know. It's like, I'm thinking, what? Sorry, I'm busy. I got to go. I got a business idea.
I got to mail something to myself so I can get a postage stamp on it. It's the confluence of things that ends up getting enough gravity to create those generations of internet where we, you know, looking back at what Web 2 was, is you're like, well, it's this and this and this and this. And then it had to get enough of that momentum in order to really define itself. You know, it's not social media. It's not mobile. It's not this. It's all those things.
Together. Yeah. Yeah.
Correct. And the metaverse is an aspect of Web3 in that way. But likely it's the experiential sort of internet that pulls a lot of it together and platforms a lot of those pillars. To me, like the thing that we're like waiting for is, the science for mass adoption, and it ends up being a bunch of different things that we don't have yet. What do you think the biggest piece of the puzzle for mass adoption to the next level? You know, so if we're in the metaverse in early stages now, what's the next stage and what's missing to get there?
Well, it's really a hardware game at the moment, because, you know, the same way that you couldn't access the internet without a computer, you can't access the metaverse. I mean, okay, sure, you can get into something like, you know, Decentraland, you know, through a screen, but through your laptop, I mean, but it's really the actual hardware of the VR headset is actually quite critical to this. But for me, the definition of the metaverse is beyond just the virtual reality experience. It also encompasses the augmented reality experience, where we actually have that union of the physical world around us, and then having the visual digital elements showing us the unseen, making the invisible visible for both information and entertainment. And that, for me, is the bigger play and the more important one, because that's actually where we start moving away from smartphones and moving towards head-mounted devices that become our main computing interface. And this is something that's going to develop over the next decade. And actually, I should say right now, I work for Nokia, but I have to clarify before anybody gets confused. We are not working on hardware. I have to say that straight out. We sold our handset business, our phone business, to Microsoft almost 10 years ago.
Yep.
We are a network company. We build we're business to business. We create the communications networks behind, you know, that their phone companies and enterprises run. So our interest in this is building the connectivity for this, because you need really, really fabulous connectivity to make any of this work. So, okay. So just little.
That's a big, I mean, that connectivity is another, I think, you know, like a lot of people have said, you know, X this or that is here. It's just not equally distributed, and it's metaverse, it's internet. Every generation has that piece. And you know, the network is a big proponent of what makes the universal, distribution, you know, reality. So it just requires the hardware too, and that's the marriage, right?
And then the next kind of wave beyond, you know, having that kind of critical mass of virtual reality headset adoption, which may not happen actually, but then the development of the augmented reality headset adoption, that's which will kind of be more 2025 and after. That's actually where the big game is. And the reason that I say that virtual reality may not ever be a totally mass market thing, and that's okay, is that for me, virtual reality, you know, and I do all my fitness in VR. Like, I'm literally in there at least an hour every single day. Huge shout out to Supernatural and VZ Fit, who are my go-tos for fitness. I lost 20 pounds at the the start of lockdown because of working, doing all my fitness in VR. Awesome. Yeah, and it gets it off. It's like, you know, love
I do all the Beat Saber stuff myself.
Yeah, just fantastic stuff.
You can trick me into exercise if there's a Star Wars element.
Exactly. I gamify it, I'm there.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing with virtual reality is when you put on that headset, as wonderful it is and as immersive it is and as life-changing as it can be, you are, because you're cutting yourself off from the physical world and you are consciously taking yourself away from everything else, it's like going to a movie theater where you walk into a dark room and you have a wonderful immersive experience, but then after a couple of hours, you come out again. So this kind of idea that we're going to do everything in that version of the metaverse, no. Just no.
Yeah,
I agree. Like having the sunshine on my face. I like having my toes.
There's a fatigue, you know. That's,
there is a fatigue.
Yeah.
And
it's natural to have that fatigue because it's an unnatural experience.
The same way. I mean, the same way that like if you go to an all-day movie festival and you see four movies back to back, you come out and you're like, oh my God, you know, it's
sensory overload. Right.
It is. And it's too much cutting off from everything else. So it's not, people say, oh, VR headsets are heavy and stuff. I actually find mine really comfortable. It's not the thing about having something on your head so much as just being cut off from everything else.
I mean, I have the same experience, you know, at day two or three in Las Vegas, you know, where I'm like, I'm good, you know. I get it.
I want to see a flower now.
Everything smells like smoke, and there's nothing that's real, and you know, there's lights and sounds all the time.
Exactly.
I get it. I want a white room now with nothing in it, please.
Exactly.
Can I put a quarter in that?
Right. So the union of kind of the okay. So, and actually, this kind of harkens back to your original question a little bit. For me, the really key question is, what problem does the metaverse solve? Because technology, there's all kinds of fabulous technology out there, but it doesn't take off. It doesn't get popular unless it solves a problem. And sometimes these are problems that are acknowledged ahead of time, and sometimes these are problems that are not acknowledged ahead of time. Like, you know, the iPad is a classic example of something like, oh, I never knew I needed a big screen that had computer stuff on it that was portable until this thing arrived. And now, oh, okay, there's actually a lot of problems that this solves that I didn't realize I had. And so, all right, so what problem does the metaverse solve? The virtual reality version of it, I submit, you know, COVID has actually been really good for this because, you know, we're entering a world where getting on a plane and going to see people face to face all the time may not always be the best solution in terms of sustainability and putting carbon into the atmosphere. But meeting other people all the time in a two-dimensional screen, it has its limitations, especially if you're dealing with some kind of collaboration or creative collaboration or something very sensitive where you really need to see a lot of body nuance. And meetings in virtual reality really do, they are much, much better than, you know, a two-dimensional meeting in something like Zooms or Teams or Zoom. There we go. Those are excellent tools, but for collaboration and particularly in three-dimensional kinds of spaces, there is nothing better than being in a fully realized three-dimensional world, talking, working with other people's avatars, getting through because you know the virtual reality headset, you know, it catches your head inclination, even if it's not catching the subtleties of your face and the way your hands are moving, you can actually get a really good idea of how somebody is thinking and moving, surprisingly good, given that it's only kind of three movement points on the person's body.
Yeah, I think that's going to get better and better
exactly.
too, because I think that's really where Web 2 becomes this paradigm of the contributing user to the internet experience, but the contributions were really wanting. I mean, primarily text, and you know that's not how we really communicate. You know,
exactly.
I mean, it's one of hundreds of signals that we give off. So, it's really, I think a lot of the friction in communication and community and collaboration comes from that sort of really mono style communication. Limitation, and this opens that up, right? So there's that. The other part of it that I'm curious to see ask you about is, so I see these the Zooms and the 2Ds of the world as efficient.
They are definitely, you know, that's no what, question.
Yeah, like I think that you can't beat them for that. What are we missing outside of efficiency when it comes to communicating and coming together that maybe the metaverse could solve? I mean, it's a weird question, I suppose, but there's other things that take place in communities that really make them more powerful and stronger bonds. Do you see the metaverse being able to offer more in that
way? I do. And I mentioned Raum earlier, which is a German meeting space for enterprises. And, you know, it's a, first of all, it's a really beautiful space. And actually, there's a lot of these, you know, Meet in VR is another one that's very good. But I'll talk about.
I'll get you in ours. But
yeah. Oh, okay.
I'm very familiar with all of these platforms.
Oh no! Am I talking about a competitor? Oh dear. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, no. It's fine.
Okay. Well, let me speak in general then. Okay.
Yeah. But we're new to the scene, but it doesn't matter.
Oh, I do need to get into yours.
Okay. Yeah, sure, okay. Sure. Yeah, we've been in the events space for a decade, and
I mean that's what I know you for. Modeling, yeah.
Yeah, that's what we've been modeling. We've been modeling spaces, and we have an inventory of hundreds of real spaces that we manipulate, and then 10,000 objects, and then but we're experienced designers at our heart. So, for us, we do, you know, we design architecture specifically for experiences, but it's all good. Like I think that like this is, we're all in the same generation, you know, we're all going to be, you know, accelerating and pivoting. And I'm like the least competitive. I mean, it's probably to, you know, not everyone's chagrin, you know, internally, but I'm the least competitive person, period. Rising tide is my, you know, my goal.
Exactly. So. We're all making this up as we go along, trying to figure out what's going to work, right?
Whoever the expert in the metaverse was, you know, who has a year over the person who just heard the
just
word,
five
right?
Minutes, so, right. Yeah. But actually, you just said the actual answer, which is the word experience, because it is about experience. And the thing is that there are studies that have been done that show that memories, human beings, the way that our brains work, we form memories very similarly in virtual reality, in the three-dimensional space, very similarly to the way that we form memories when we're in the physical world. But if we're looking at a two-dimensional screen, right, that forms a different kind of memory. And so the having the experience of being in VR is very close in terms of how your brain perceives it to being in the physical world. Yeah, man. Yeah. And, you know, which also means, you know, with great responsibility, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, you know, so that means you got to be really careful not to misuse VR. But the ability to...
Yeah, the data collected...
Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, privacy, yeah. I mean, privacy. Yeah.
I come from a world of... behavioral science and intentional experience design based on cognitive biases.
Oh,
so there's a big, you know, we're always kind of walking the line of like, we say nudging, you know, we don't say manipulation, you know, but there's always that line of what we, you know, what we do, you know, in the observation. I mean, observation to things I've worked on with biometric feedback and facial recognition, you know, all the stuff that makes people squirm, I've used in live environments as a way to gauge emotional response to stimulus. And it's, you know, there's a lot you can learn, but I know for a fact is that when you have wearables involved, it's an exponential increase. Like beacons, okay, you know, I can learn a little bit, but the biometric the biometric feedback is... Oof, I mean, I know how you're feeling, you know, and can track that to eye movement and can track that to your day. And I could psychologically program, you know, a lot based on that. And, you know, it's good and it's bad, you know, for sure. And I think that if there's a level of transparency involved, I think that's really the key. I think most people
exactly and user control
are into it if they have the control.
Precisely, yeah. Precisely. And if people understand what you're doing and why, and you know,
it's a burden on them though. Most users like I've always found that to be the challenge. I really want the education to rise above, you know, for people to understand what they're giving away for free stuff.
Well, you know, and I wonder how much, you know, people's data is actually going to become the next, you know, or a kind of currency in the metaverse where, you know, this particular platform, if you let all of your data be shared, it's free. But if you only let some data be shared, then you have to pay a certain amount. I mean, I think that kind of thing is certainly possible.
I think it is too. My fear always is, you know, the mass education of the populace to understand the value of their own data. I see the data freely given away. So the enterprise is, you know, all above board when they collect your data. But, it's not really technically their fault. But the consumer doesn't really understand what they're giving away and the implications. Right. And I think there's a lot of good that could be done in that. But that's a whole thing, that's a whole other line of that's a web two problem that I hope doesn't come to web 3. Do you know what I mean? Like,
I know, I want to solve some of these things before. I think that one's inevitable, but you know,
I know too.
Yeah.
It's the walled gardens, right? I mean, like that's the big fear when people talk about the idea of the metaverse's potential and not reaching its potential is the idea of these walled gardens.
Right.
I have a hard time seeing a world without them. I mean, I see
agree.
The utopia, but I also am such a realist.
Well, if you look at today, we have the internet but I enter the internet on a Chrome browser and somebody else might be using Safari, and that actually affects what it is that you see. And I happen to have an iPhone and somebody else has an Android, and that affects what areas and what functionalities you get. So we already are living in these quite large walled gardens that are determined by Silicon Valley companies. And I think that's not going to change. I think we are going to have, things like Ready Player Me, where you have an avatar that is portable across multiple worlds and digital goods and all of that kind of stuff. Those kind of crossovers are going to happen, and that's wonderful. But I think the kind of, here is the universe that you enter through the company Meta, and then here is the universe that you enter through the company, Apple, Amazon, whatever. They're going to be different universes. And
I think so,
right?
Too.
But one of the things that we also know from mobile computing and from our experience in just the mobile world, text messaging. Now, the SMS channel on phones, that was a signaling channel that was meant just for engineers to use in the background. So opening up commercially, it wasn't designed to be used commercially. And then when companies started realizing, oh, consumers might be interested in just writing each other a short message, let's try this. Yeah. And so that kind of happened on us back in the 90s. It was a slow rollout process country by country. And what would happen in almost every country is that first, one phone company would let people send text messages only to people who also were in that same phone company. And
I recall.
Yeah. And the thing is that, like, I don't know what brand of phone or what, plan my friend has. This is ridiculous.
I had that problem with my dad today. My dad's like, did you just text me something? And I was like, no, I added a smiley face to your text. And I'm on an iOS and he's not. So he's like, I just got an alert.
Yeah. So is this kind of ridiculous?
It still persists.
That stuff still persists. But you couldn't even send a message to somebody who was off your network at the beginning.
Yeah.
And it's,
I had to know who was in it.
But the thing is that once you got the interoperability of texting within a particular country, and then ultimately across the whole world, you get this network effect. And the network effect is that when there are more people who are in the network, then the usage and the value of that network grows exponentially. So now I don't have to worry about who I'm sending it to. And now the usage of SMS, and so once that was in place, then the usage of SMS just completely exploded. And so the metaverse will need those bridges. Well, whatever they are, for it to truly take off, there are going to need to be these things that connect. Yeah. And I don't know what form it's going to take, because the metaverse itself, again, going back to that, the virtual reality version of it, it's a post-text world. And so that makes me wonder, what does a search engine in the metaverse look like? I don't even really...
Discoverability is
going to
be...
Oh, it's a huge problem that's going to need to be solved. And whoever solves it is going to make a boatload of money.
Because it's not only an infinite landscape, it's stacked infinite landscapes.
Right.
So that's the element of it when I think of search around it that I can't get my brain around currently. It's placement. And it's placement in a point in space on a horizontal and axis, let's say. But it's also the vertical amongst other platforms that are stacked. So like you're going to want to, like, how is that going to come
down? Exactly. And how do you find things that are not labeled with some kind of a text label, like you know, okay, JP Morgan, I think they just opened up a bank in Decentraland. So I can, that's something I can type in text somewhere and say, you know, where can I find JP Morgan in,
like, it reminds me of AOL chat, you know, like,
right,
you'd go to,
right. But it's text-based. And the thing is, again, when you're in virtual reality, you don't have a keyboard in front of you. So, well, I mean, some, you can get one to pop up and stuff, but text is...
But that's not the natural interface.
That's not the natural thing, right? That's not the natural interface. Yeah. So how do we make this happen with voice, with gesture, with some kind of moving... Post-text is, you know, that's what I'm calling it, but I don't know what it looks like yet. And so, yeah, so these are kind of the problems that need to be solved.
Once, there's a lot of those neural interface hardware pieces that some of the billionaires are working
that
on.
May be the
that seems like even more, you know, out there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I know that, like, Amazon and Tesla or whatever, whichever company of his is that, are working on these neural interfaces. I really am curious to see how that, like, that's something that is at least spiritually in line with what the gesture, or like what the platform should be like,
right.
You know, something that is seem, because it seems like really clunky if you have a keyboard. I mean, it's just, or even a phone.
Right, exactly. Like, there's just no point there. I mean, Google is actually starting to creep towards this. I think it was just recently that they have unveiled their kind of multimodal search. I'm not sure what the official term is, but where you can use image and text together. So, So if you say, like, okay, you know, here's a blue shoe. I'm looking for a shoe like this, but in orange and gray.
Yeah.
Terrible.
This but green. But, or
yeah,
like that.
Exactly. And then using that together. So, okay, well, how do we get these multiple flows in here? Like, is it that I craft in the same way that today I would type text into a browser, is that I quickly craft up something in virtual reality and say, look for something like this object that I just built, this little
pulling
virtual
out a wallet
gerbil.
Indicates you're looking to bank.
You know, it's a, where are gerbils, you know? Show me where the gerbils are.
Yeah.
And yeah, but I don't know. I'm just throwing ideas out there.
I mean,
yeah.
Gaming has a lot of the idea of inventory.
Yes.
And objects and things like that. So maybe that's, you know, an interface that is, you know, in that.
Well, and actually, I mean, NVIDIA has created.
When you were talking about AR, like, that to me makes the most amount of sense to be able to pull that stuff
there
up,
we
like
go.
To search for things.
There we go.
You know, in the real world.
Yeah.
Show me just restaurants against the real world.
Okay, you know what? Like, I'm going to pull you up right there. What you experience in virtual reality is also real. So mm-hmm. I'm very careful to say the digital world. Or the physical world, because they are both both real.
Sure. It's perception. Yeah. I mean, it's difficult with the terms that latch on versus the terms that are the most articulate explanations of things. When you communicate these things, I agree. Like in the the AR world, like I enjoy that, and I think that's I'm with you that has less fatigue and has more potential as far as hours spent, and it's much more organic in the integration of it. And I think that, like, likely some of the, if that's the case, if that's like the default experience, it's, you know, life plus, I think a lot of the gesturing and things like that likely will come from there, because it's where the majority of your time is spent.
Yes.
And thus might AR might actually influence VR in
I
that
think
way.
You're right. And excuse me. And, you know, and they will shade into each other. They both involve wearing something on the head. And the thing is that augmented reality, I already wear glasses. I already have something on my head 16 hours a day or more.
Yeah.
And
I did until LASIK. And I'll get the LASIK
the
equivalent
VR,
of
AR surgery. Yeah.
No, I'll get the surgery for my eyes for when they get really down, you know.
But but the real power I mentioned before about solving problems, the problem that AR solves is the problem of us needing to look at a screen all the time. Because right now, if 95%, you know, taking away kind of the voice assistant world, 95% of the stuff that we do that involves a computer involves us looking at a screen. And so the idea, you know, the social cost of going out to a restaurant, say with your family and everybody's sitting, or your friends, and everybody's sitting around the table staring at their phones, that is ridiculous. And that is a problem that needs to be solved. And so putting the computing on your head and now having the computing be something that you look through, and having the computing look at the world the same way that you do, and taking its context from where your gaze is falling, that eliminates that screen and it puts you back in the world. And that is super important for humanity. And so when people,
we're in a transitional period.
We are. And it's a silly transitional period that people will laugh at.
When you look back at this time, I think you're going to look back at, this time period in history, and documentaries and things of the 2000s, and you're going to see people looking at phones, and you're going to be like, oh, they may as well be riding one of those giant wheeled bikes. Or
exactly.
There was a couple years at Disney that I was, I used to go to Disney a couple times a year because I did a lot of speaking, and inevitably Orlando and Anaheim are destinations. So I would just go to Disney, and I like to watch people in the least creepy way I can say that. I don't know how to do that. But one of the things I would do, I would try to make them into like little anthropology projects. And there was a couple years where I was taking pictures of people while they allowed it with the selfie sticks. And I was just like, this is not going to last. And this is a kind of, an example of technology's ability to go faster than our ability to be able to rectify how to integrate it in our lives. And it's less than natural. I mean, it is the weirdest looking thing. So I was just capturing people who should be the least amount of devices in their hands, the most amount of attention given to spectacle. And yet, not only were they looking at it, they were looking at it on a stick. And I was like, there's something to that. And so I have like a whole Dropbox folder of people at Disney taking selfies with selfie sticks. And I just look back at that stuff and saying like, this isn't what we were meant. This isn't what this is.
This is not the end point here. Yeah. This is a stage. No. This is a developmental stage.
Yeah. This is like the planes that, were crashing in the black and white films before the Wright brothers, monetized it or whatever they did, before they patent trolled everybody out of it. But I find this kind of stuff super exciting, where it's all of the experimental versions of things, because who knows, this could be the way we do it, or this could be the way we do it.
Well,
and it's really fun to be able to see those paths.
Exactly. And bring it back kind of to the topic of events, and permissions. I mean, one of the, because I do a lot of speaking as well, and it's usually with our customers, and who are the phone companies of the world, and I'm usually talking to the CXO level. And it's happened more than once that some guy in a sweater slides in late, doesn't get introduced, sits down, and then says something that, takes issue with something that I'm saying, and then I end up arguing with him, and it turns out it's the CEO, and everybody's going, like, stop. So one of the really useful things that I can see is say at an event or in something where you're in a customer's building or something, getting permission, because everybody is there. It's the same way as wearing name tags, right? Getting permission to have your glasses be able to do facial recognition on everybody, and they gave permission to have their face in the database or not. And then if they start talking to you, then their name and title and company pop up as a little subtitle. Yes, please.
Yeah, please. The context would be invaluable. Yes. You know who you're talking to.
I would not start arguing with CEOs, or just even, in random, encounters at a conference, who was that guy? What company did he work for? I never knew, because the whole
and banking that information so you can follow up.
Absolutely. I mean,
the cool thing about events, because I've worked a lot at the intersection of data collection and live events, is that most of the time when you attend event, it is to be anything but anonymous. So the things that we, the fears we have, about like facial recognition, out in the world, and privacy, become less of an issue with people who attend events, because the sort of social contract is that you are there to
network.
Be you know, presence. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's actually, there's a lot less friction. Like even the opt-ins that I'm able to get at the level I've got with a facial recognition deployment that I've used, or biometric feedback in sample groups or in large groups, it's been easy. And I couldn't do that at like a shopping mall.
Right, exactly. I mean, cause you can geofence these things so that it, you know, it only works in the main event hall, you know, or whatever.
Correct.
Yeah. And it would just be invaluable. Cause you know, even I was just at South by Southwest and you meet so many fascinating people. But there's this kind of politeness thing where you're talking to somebody and you're like, oh, this is a really interesting person. And then you have to like break your gaze and like, you can see when people are doing it. Look down at the name tag, right? There. You know?
and then look them up on LinkedIn while you're talking to them?
I mean, and like, then look back up and they know that you've just checked out like their name and stuff.
Yeah.
And so, you know, let's just make that a lot less frictional.
Yeah, boy, that's... I love that. I love that. Like to be able to give context, to be able to say, who am I talking to? And then how much more potent would the conversations be if you were talking to someone and you knew they're like, oh, you're, and it would be, I would imagine pretty quickly that you're like, for instance, I've noticed that like when I had live events and that was the only way I came in contact with certain people, and there would be a year that would go by in between that, there was huge lulls and sort of time wasting a bit in keeping up with what they've been doing. Meanwhile, post 2008 or so, like with social media, you know, I follow them and I kind of like keep up, so the conversations are so much more effortless. You know, like I have that bridge of digital communication that keeps the conversation going, so to speak. So like the in-person is so much more valuable. And I can imagine the next level of that, of actually having that stuff augment the conversation with someone I just met, you know, to be able to give me additional context.
Right. And
super
yeah,
cool.
You know, and I mean, anyway, you can just kind of imagine all of these different things. And so when people talk about the metaverse, you know, and only keep the conversation in that virtual reality world, you know, they're not looking at the whole thing. Yeah, because it's for me, it is actually, as I said, that union of the digital and the physical that is actually going to transform our physical lives more, because when augmented reality headsets are able to bring us to make the invisible visible and to bring us information and entertainment that is not integrated with our physical reality right now. And it's going to be transformational.
Yeah, that's great. I can just see it being the extra level on everything without feeling like the weight of it is an extra level on things. Like that's the dream.
Effortless. Yeah. And it's not going to be like that at the beginning, the same way, you know, the first mobile phones were like really big and clunky. And then when they did, you know, the first mobile phones only made phone calls. So the first headsets are really very limited in functionality. They are headsets, I mean. But that's okay, because they will slowly add the functionality. And then as people start wearing them, I frankly think that a killer use case for the first AR headsets, you know, AR headset manufacturers, I hope you're listening, is just, you know, subtitles for everyday life. You know, I have the subtitles on when I watch TV. My hearing's fine, but, you know, I'm a visual person. I like to read stuff. And, you know, so wouldn't it be great if, you know, you could get subtitles?
Just AI that does conversation.
Right. Well, and the thing is that, you know, and this is where our industry gets involved, because for the augmented reality headsets to be light enough and, you know, fashionable enough that people would actually want to wear them, for the battery to last long enough, you have to take the computing off of that device and put it in the network somewhere. So
100%.
Yeah. And so what has to happen is that you say something to me, the audio is captured by my glasses, it's sent over the network to the computing place, which is somewhere in the network, and then the computing place comes back with the subtitle, which then displays, and that all happened in milliseconds. And so it's that connectivity and that quality of the connectivity and the compute sitting in the network. That's where my company's interested.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and the good news is that there's really nothing we can accomplish. And good news for you.
I know. We're right in the middle of this.
No matter what happens,
we're there.
If your vision to be, you know, real, we have to be a big part of it. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm excited to see, you know, a return to, you know, all the perks of technology and more of the return to natural human behavior.
Yes.
Like that to me is going to be super exciting. And I think it'll make a big difference.
When I hear people talking about like being afraid of the metaverse is something that will cause people to, you know, the Ready Player One scenario where,
yeah,
like, where it's,
yeah,
it's,
yeah,
you know, the physical reality is like, you know, people huddled, quivering, you know, away from the physical world because it's just so horrible. No, the metaverse is about bringing people together, and particularly the augmented reality angle of it. But both of them are about people and bringing people together. Yeah.
I think every time that's a fear that ends up being not the case. I think that people downplay natural human tendencies of community and wanting to, you know, be free from the shackles of things.
Absolutely.
I mean, you could gamers, there are, you know, two or three video gamers that have dehydration problems in a massive level annually, globally, but they're statistical anomalies. I mean, the immersiveness that exists in that world, you would say is potentially, you know, next to that. And yet they don't do that 24/7. You know, it's not a widespread thing. I really don't think that no matter how good it is, that we're going to all of a sudden not contribute to society because these worlds exist. I really, you know, I think that you're doing humanity a disservice to think that like people would be in there en masse constantly, especially if there's an alternative that is integrated. I mean, once they see that, then they're like, why would I be cut off completely all the
exactly.
time?
Exactly. And I just recently heard, and I've been racking my brain, I don't remember who said this, but it was kind of the three secrets to human happiness, or the three keys to human happiness, is to have something to do, someone to love, and something to hope for. And I'm like, sure. Okay, yeah, that's pretty good. And it resonates with me. And the thing is that the metaverse actually has the potential to offer people expanded possibilities in all three of those categories. And so for me,
I agree.
That's the power of the metaverse. And in a way, that's kind of really ultimately what its full purpose is going to be, making us happy.
Love that. Yeah. That's a great way to end this. Thanks so much, Leslie. I love the enthusiasm and I love the optimistic vision that you have. It's what we make of it, obviously. But I do think that we're at the beginnings of something that will feel a lot more human, even though there's a lot more technology involved. I think the technology is aiming us towards a more human relationship with each other. And that's the kind of stuff that I'm personally really excited about seeing. Appreciate your time.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. This has been a really fun conversation. And I feel like we could keep going for about 6 more hours. But
yeah, for sure. I mean, this is all I ever read about, think about, you know, I spent my entire career thinking about what it takes to bring people together. And, you know, it takes a lot of different forms and I love them all.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I really just love people coming together and what comes from that. And there's a lot of different ways to do it. And now there's more. So it's like, I feel like I have, you know, more crayons in my coloring box to, you know, do it differently in different combinations.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah.
Great. So if our listeners wanted to, you know, continue following what you're up to and things that you're in your world, where would they go and do that?
You can follow me on LinkedIn. I'm sure mm-hmm. Leslie Shannon Nokia will bring you to me. And sure. Yeah.
We'll have that in their show notes too. So that's
yeah,
great.
Exactly. And actually I've got some, videos up on YouTube talking about the metaverse from more of the technical enablers of the metaverse angle. And so if you just cool. type Leslie Shannon Metaverse into YouTube, one of them is Polish subtitled. That one's fun. so particularly for the Polish speakers out there.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, we can put those videos in the show notes.
Oh,
too,
fantastic. Okay,
that's,
great.
That's great. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you again. If anyone here wants to reach out to us at the show, it's exchange@allseated.com. And I just want to thank everyone for listening and being an active agent of positive change. So thanks very much. Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you.
So why is the metaverse inevitable? Or is it?
It is absolutely inevitable because we are always finding new ways to reach out to each other. And this is a way that we can erase time and space distances and actually be with each other in a way that actually has meaning.
What's the best part of what the metaverse is or will be?
The best part is freedom. and freedom, both freedom to do things and freedom from things. In a digital world, everything is possible. I mean, I go into an NFT gallery in virtual reality right now, and I'm like, why is this shaped like an art gallery in the physical world? This could be anything. This could be anything. So I think, you know, we're going to, we're going to be exploding beyond, you know, emulating worlds with gravity, because we don't need to in the metaverse. But there's also the freedom from, and a lot of that is the freedom from judgment. Because if there is something about me that means that other people tend to judge me negatively in the real world, whatever that may be, when I go into the metaverse, I can be a giant banana. And then people don't know that I have, you know, three arms or, you know, whatever it is that makes people look at me kind of funny in the physical world. And so I think the freedom to create and the freedom to create yourself is actually one of the most compelling things about the metaverse.
Okay, what would it take for people to want to work in the metaverse? Doesn't have to be 24/7, could be part of it.
Okay, I think for that one, we're going to need to have a hardware change. Meta right now, they have in their workrooms, they've got this thing where you can actually kind of, you're seeing, if you look up, you're seeing the virtual reality room around you. If you look down, you're seeing your actual keyboard. That's a good question, because the metaverse is excellent for collaboration. It is less good for anything that has to do with text. So I don't really have a good answer for that.
Portions then.
Portions. I guess the collaboration stuff is going to effortlessly move in there. Other stuff, maybe once we kind of get beyond using text, I don't know.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be everything. It just has to be better than some of the things that we're
doing. Fair point.
What's a positive change that could come to the world in mass through the adoption of the metaverse?
I think better understanding of other peoples and other cultures, because one of the things that I see with my kids who play a lot of Fortnite, and I consider that to be, you know, if not fully metaverse, then metaverse adjacent. And the thing is that the people that they meet when they're playing are people from all over the world. And so just as kind of an example, when, you know, a bubble tea shop opened up down the road here in my town in California, I knew what bubble tea was because I've been to, you know, Hong Kong and Singapore, but my kids knew about it because they have interacted with other kids from those areas in their gaming universes, in their metaverses. And so my kids have a much better understanding of the rest of the world than I had in their age, at their age. And so I think the generations to come are going to understand each other better in a way without even questioning it than we grownups do. And a lot of it's going to be down to the metaverse.
Lastly, is there anything that people should be worried about with the onset of the metaverse?
Yeah, definitely.
Go in with like about, let's say.
Yeah, I think, you know, always be aware of privacy and privacy of others and data security. Those are going to continue to be issues that we need to be concerned about. Also, you know, I've been in virtual reality areas and had like 13-year-old boys come crowding up against me, and that's not pleasant. privacy bubbles or whatever it takes so that people feel safe. Mental safety is actually really important, and so that's something that platforms can actually do a lot about.
Love that.
Corporate metaverse with Metaverse. Collaborate in digital workspaces designed to accelerate sales, provide immersive brand experiences, and support thriving work environments. Metaverse by All Seated. Start now at metaverse.com. Thanks for listening to Exchange. What's your take on the conversation? Share your thoughts at exchange@allseated.com. To catch every episode of Exchange, subscribe now.